Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The House voted to provide $162 billion for President Bush to carry out U.S. military operations in both Iraq and Afghanistan through the end of his term. Congressional leaders also struck a deal with the White House that would be the most sweeping rewrite of the government's domestic surveillance powers in three decades. And presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Obama opts out of public financing for his general election campaign. With me in the studio for the Friday News Roundup, syndicated columnist Tony Blankley, Susan Page of USA Today, and Eugene Robinson of The Washington Post. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Susan Page, how were the White House and the House Democrats able to reach agreement on the massive emergency spending bill to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think they each got some of what they wanted. The president got, the White House got $162 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This means that his fight on funding these wars is over. This will be enough money through the rest of his term. It will be the next president who fights the next battle over whether and how to fund those two wars. But the Democrats got something they wanted, too, especially an expansion of the GI Bill that will give veterans who enlisted after 9/11 and served for at least 3 years essentially the ability to go and get a four-year education at a public university.
And there was actually some funding for flood relief, wasn't there, Gene?
Right. There was funding for flood relief in there. Was that the $3 billion that the president has talked about?
I think so. And Tony.
The biggest story here is that the president got what he wanted on foreign policy, including surveillance, because I think the Democrats are afraid to not give him what he wants for fear that something bad might happen. On the other hand, he's capitulating on the domestic front because the Democrats have the whip hand on that. So you're seeing that play out. The fear of foreign policy reversals stopping the Democrats from blocking the president.
But then the question becomes, how does this spending bill affect the next president? Does it in any way tie his hands?
Well, it means there's funding for the war until that issue gets addressed by the next president. It does give this big new entitlement. I mean, there's a lot of support for this education measure because, you know, all of us are indebted to U.S. troops who have been serving abroad, especially since 9/11. But it's expensive. And the provision that would have paid for this new benefit was struck from the bill. So the Democrats are violating their own budget rules, which called for providing a way to fund new measures like this. Yeah. So it will increase, the deficit that the next president will need to deal with.
The Democrats are acting like Republicans. It's amazing. But no, I mean, it's a significant bill. You know, I don't know if we'll have another piece of legislation this significant, certainly before the election.
The last big spending bill that the president gets. What about this bipartisan deal on domestic spying? What's happening there, Tony?
That's the other piece of it. The president got largely what he wanted. He wanted to have the authority. He wanted the big telephone companies who had cooperated with providing information to the government to be legally protected from lawsuits. And he got most of what he wanted there. He wanted to have the courts out of it entirely. The Democrats, he compromised on letting a judge have one call on whether or not to determine whether the telephone company had been told in writing from the government to help, which I think it was the case in all the instances. So it wasn't much. The president didn't give up much. But this is another example, as what I was mentioning just before, that I don't think the Democratic Congress, when it comes to it, wants to take a chance on taking a terrorism-fighting tool out of the president's hands in these last few months before the election.
You know, Democrats who oppose the retroactive immunity are quite upset about this. Well, they don't see it as much of a compromise. Senator Feingold called it a capitulation by Democrats because it basically gives the telephone companies retroactive immunity. It gives the president what he wants. And it's a demonstration that even though the president is at very low approval ratings in the high 20s, you know, the country feels like we're going in the wrong direction. He retains this ability to, on these two measures we've just talked about, to get a lot of what he wants in the twilight of his presidency.
Well, it's because, I believe it's because the Democrats genuinely are afraid on this terrorism and security issue. They don't want to be caught in a position of appearing to deny the president what he needs to defend the country. Heaven forbid, should something happen, should there be some sort of incident, they don't want to be the ones who are blamed for it.
And
they're just very nervous about that going into the election.
It's interesting that you've got civil liberties groups really blasting the Democrats for this, and Nancy Pelosi is saying it's a balanced bill.
Well, she points to a provision that says the president must abide by this in doing eavesdropping. That there, you know, there was concern that President Bush has gone around existing laws. This says this is the law that has to apply, and she describes that as a victory and an important component. Although on the core issue that we've been, how long have we been talking about this on the Friday News Roundup, on the core issue of retroactive immunity, the administration got what it wanted.
And the other core issue, the war funding bill. I mean, you know, the Democrats were elected to, it's in 2006, essentially to end the war, and they passed funding bill after funding bill.
Washington Post columnist Eugene Robinson, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and syndicated columnist Tony Blankley. He's a research fellow with the Heritage Foundation. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. On Wednesday, Tony, President Bush called on Congress to lift the ban on offshore oil drilling. Number one, what would that achieve in your view? And number two, how likely is the president going to get what he wants?
Well, fascinating. There are two pieces to it. There was the 81 legislation, and then there was a 1990 executive order. He could have withdrawn or rewritten the executive order. He chose not to. He's only putting it in Congress's hand.
Now, who issued that executive order?
Bush Sr. 1990, we know who was president then. This is a fascinating issue because I've been involved in environmental and business issues going back to the 70s in politics, and Republicans have always tried to contrast, tell the public, do you want jobs or do you want a green environment? And the public has always said we want both. And so Republicans have been losing on that argument for 30 years. Now with gas at $4 a gallon going up five, maybe higher, the issue is now that the environmental purity may get between an American and his car, will that same desire with Americans to ask for both but demand environmental standards, as they always have, is that going to break or not? And I think, I'm not sure yet, but I think that McCain is on the right side of the issue, him switching to drilling, and I wouldn't be surprised if Obama tries to get off of his anti-drilling position in the next few weeks.
Susan.
Well, I agree. We've seen some shift, I think, in public opinion. There was a Gallup poll on this issue that's found that 57% of Americans said they supported the idea of allowing more drilling offshore. But, you know, that's not universal. People in the middle of the country who aren't affected are more likely to support this than people in California and Florida on the east and west coast that see this as more directly impinging upon their beaches and their tourist industries and the environment in which they live. But I agree that $4 a gallon gasoline has done a lot to grab Americans' attentions and make them very concerned about how can we get into a situation where I'm not paying.
And keep in mind, this is deep water exploration. This is 50 miles to 200 miles out. It's not on the shore.
And the question is, why aren't they drilling on land that they already have that has already been leased to them? And the question remains, how much are they going to get from offshore drilling? We don't know, but The other part of this is that SUVs are now sitting on car lots.
Right. You can't get rid of them. They're just amazing. I have a friend who had a big SUV and was trying to get rid of it. The car is probably worth $30,000 and was being offered $8,000
wow.
for the car.
Yeah.
Because dealerships were saying, we cannot sell this thing.
And the question becomes, what is the chance that Congress is going to drop the ban?
I think probably not. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Tony. I think it's even though there's a kind of shift in public opinion, it seems to me that that's not something that's going to happen.
It's going to depend. I talked to a Democratic campaign consultant yesterday who was advising his candidates, different candidates around the country, to come out in favor of drilling in their campaign. Now, these are candidates who are moderate to liberal candidates and normally would not be taking that position. It depends how intensely this issue develops. I mean, we have until, what, September before Congress leaves town. If it becomes a central issue or one of the central concerns of the public, there might be increased pressure. I agree the national instinct is to think they do nothing because it goes against the
But
the
it would be 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. The central issue to me is whether these two things, you know, four
really
or now $5 a gallon gasoline is where we're heading, and offshore drilling, if they become linked in the public mind in a way that they can't be separated again.
Although a federal study just last year said that this would not, allowing additional offshore drilling would not have an effect on gas prices until 2030, which is a long time down the road. Oh. But I think that Senator Obama is in a slightly difficult position because he needs to make that argument that it won't have any quick payoff. And on the gas tax holiday, where he also differs with Senator McCain, it's also, he argues that it's a gimmick. But on the other hand, if you're really feeling pressure on gas prices, it might sound appealing.
Susan Page of USA Today. Take a short break. When we come back, more of our topics, especially the economy and your calls. Stay with us. And welcome back to our Friday News Roundup this week with Susan Page of USA Today, syndicated columnist Tony Blankley, author of The West Last Chance, and Washington Post columnist Eugene Robinson. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. News on the economy here. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson called on Congress to begin debate on giving new protective powers to the Federal Reserve. What's he talking about, Susan?
You know, this really relates to some of the turmoil we've seen in markets with the subprime mortgage collapse, including the collapse of Bear Stearns, where he wants the Fed to have kind of more formalized oversight of the health of these financial institutions. That the Fed stepped in and helped bail out the situation after the Bear Stearns collapse. And he wants to make that, he wants to increase their powers to do that, although he also proposes limiting their current powers to oversee the day-to-day regulation of banks. So it's a situation that would change slightly kind of the role of the Fed in overseeing the health of these institutions.
I mean, one big question is whether the Fed can do what these institutions fail to do in their own interest, which is to gauge the amount of total risk they have, where that risk was, and what would happen if something went wrong. And that essentially is what happened with the subprime crisis. Nobody knew who owed what to whom, with what collateral, et cetera, and it kind of fell apart.
And on the same day that Paulson made his remarks, two former, now former, Bear Stearns managers were arrested. Talk about the charges, Tony.
Yeah, they were basically charged with making happy talk to potential purchasers of their assets while they were privately scornful of the value of those assets based on emails that had been found by
investigators. I'm getting awfully upset about these people who do this stuff.
You know, I mean, on the other hand, people who are customers for hedge funds are not you and me. I mean, these are sophisticated consumers.
Big monies.
Who are buying this stuff. And to a certain extent, while I'm not endorsing misrepresentation, they're very sophisticated customers who presumably should be doing research. On the other hand, it doesn't mean these people shouldn't be convicted for if they've committed a crime.
You people deserve to get an honest read.
I know. I'm just saying. But going back to Paulson, because I think this is a fascinating moment, because his recommendations are coming at a moment when the traditional tools of the Fed, which is basically to change the overnight bank rate and to increase the money supply by work on the open market, are seen to be insufficient to manage the problems of inflation and increasing liquidity at a time with the financial market. So he's trying to find, a lot of people are trying to find new tools for the Fed to manage under new circumstances. Now, whether he's got the mix right, the Bank of England has the same mix he's proposing, but people in England say that was a mistake and was one of the reasons they had problems with their bank management.
But, you know, these indictments are an example of old tools being used.
And good
like
ones.
Grand juries and arrests.
Prosecuting crooks is always used.
Putting guys in handcuffs.
As a former prosecutor, I'm
in
favor.
Well, and in addition, you've got two senators who have acknowledged that they got lower rates on their mortgages as part of the VIP program for Countrywide Financial, Susan.
Now, it's Senator Conrad and Senator Dodd. Senator Dodd had an unusual press conference this week to explain, saying he didn't have any idea that he was getting special treatment, but then acknowledged that he had been aware for several years that he was in the VIP program at Countrywide, but had no idea this would convey any special privileges, although it seems sort of implicit in the phrase VIP.
It does, and the fact of a VIP program tends to indicate that you're getting something that other people aren't getting. That's what it tends to indicate.
So somebody's going to give $10,000 to charity.
Well, that's Senator Conrad, who says he's refinancing one mortgage, paying off the other, and giving the $10,000 he saved through his preferential treatment to charity. Senator Dodd, who chairs this chairs the Housing Committee, has not made those kind of commitments. And now senators, the issue is being investigated by the Senate Ethics Committee on both senators' parts.
And meanwhile, the White House says President Bush would veto a foreclosure rescue bill that the Senate began debating yesterday. Tony, how is Countrywide playing into that decision?
Well, I mean, according to the Wall Street Journal yesterday, the bill that Senator Dodd introduced related to this potentially could provide a bailout of more than $25 billion for Countrywide-originated loans. So there is the bill might be good in any event, but it's tainted. It's somewhat tainted by the circumstances under which it arose. And by the way, let me point out, The buzz around the Hill is it's not just a couple of senators, that there's going to be a longer list of members.
Really?
It's not going to, you know, somebody mentioned the check bouncing scandal of the 90s. I don't think it'll be that big, but in other words, it'll be more players than one thinks, which is why the leadership apparently doesn't want to get into looking into it too closely.
They were friends of Angelo, right?
Friends of Angelo.
I'm referring to the name of the first name of the CEO of
Angelo Mazzillo.
Right. And I don't think we have any friends of Angelo here in the room.
No.
But FOA
I could have used Angelo.
Right. Where was Angelo when we needed him?
All right. Let's talk about Campaign 08. Barack Obama is the first major presidential candidate since the 1970s to reject taxpayer financing for the general election. How does he justify the decision? Doesn't it open him up to a lot of criticism, Eugene?
It does, but I think I think the campaign has made a calculation that it's certainly worth taking the criticism. I mean, he has demonstrated the ability to raise untold, unthought, undreamed amounts of money,
and in small amounts.
Exactly, from small donors in $25 donations, $50 donations from a donor base that now numbers in the millions. And so this is a potentially an enormous advantage going into the general election. And so once you establish that, it's not realistic to think that Obama's going to unilaterally disarm and put himself on the same financial footing as McCain. So then I think then we're down to the level of looking for the rationale. And it seems to come down to a subordinate clause in something that he said last year about,
I think that understates the commitment that he made in the past. He signed a questionnaire with the Midwest Democracy Institute saying, it said, will you participate in public financing if your opponent does? And he said, yes. He then said he would aggressively pursue an agreement with his Republican counterpart to try to stay within public financing. And in a debate, in one of the primary debates, he repeated that and said that I will sit down with John McCain to try to get a deal that would work. They didn't do those things. And I understand why they didn't do it. He's going to have three or four times more money than John McCain will have. And I don't think this is a big voting issue for Americans, but I do think he has violated or abandoned a pledge that he pretty clearly made earlier in the campaign.
I would absolutely agree with you. I was just trying to quote his rationale.
It's true that he's got 1.5 million small contributors, which is a tremendous asset. It's also true, I think, although I haven't seen the recent numbers, that he's beating McCain on the traditional big contributors as well. He's got a huge bundling operation, and McCain has a moderately sized bundling operation. So there is big money being influenced as well. But let me say this. Other than the valuation that Obama may place on the promise he made some months ago, this is maybe a strategically decisive decision for the campaign for him. Being able to outspend on advertising by 3-1 allows him to constantly enhance his message and degrade McCain's message, and it may be strategically decisive. This may decide the election, absent some shocking thing, all by itself. We've never seen this ratio of spending.
And a Democrat, this is what Democrats usually say about Republicans, about their big money advantage. We saw him yesterday go up with ads in 18 states, and it included the states you'd expect, like Ohio and Missouri, but it also included Alaska and Montana, Georgia, states that Democrats don't usually compete in. He'll have the ability to do that because of this money.
And he can make Republicans spend money that they don't want to spend in North Carolina.
By his advertising ability, being able to get into Indiana 3 weeks before Hillary could on advertising. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was decisive in March, April, and May for him against Hillary.
And now he has the endorsement of Al Gore.
He has the endorsement of Al Gore, finally, but Gore came through. I'm not sure what impact that really has at this late stage. It would have had more impact, I think, during the primary campaign. It's, I guess the last major figure in the party who hadn't had his say.
Has Bill Clinton endorsed Obama?
No. Well, no.
I haven't heard anything about that.
That would be an interesting endorsement.
Let's talk a little about Obama's campaign tightening control of his image, because apparently his staff allegedly barred two Muslim women from sitting behind him at a campaign rally. What happened? Was that a big mistake, Susan?
I think it was a big mistake. Senator Obama's acknowledged that, and he called one of the women involved yesterday and apologized to her himself. You've seen these scenes every primary night where it's clearly a pretty carefully selected group behind the candidate, and that's true for not just Obama, other candidates too. The issue here was that they were trying to choosing people to go up and make this tableau behind Barack Obama at the Detroit event with Al Gore, and they invited some people. When it turned out they were accompanied by women who were wearing scarves, they said they didn't want them up there. So, of course, that's offensive, which the campaign's acknowledged and apologized for. So
Well, but the thing is, I mean, both parties, the candidates do this. Republicans always try to put more blacks into their background because Republicans don't have as many black voters. The Democrats want to have more whites in their background because they don't have enough white voters. I mean, so this is the oldest game in setting up the framed shot of the candidate. But the denial by the campaign that was just a couple of local volunteers is silly. This is obviously and traditionally is a campaign strategy that is implemented by a hired staff based on the strategy of the campaigns.
So the Obama campaign has been quite sensitive about inaccurate rumors that circulate that he's a Muslim himself. I interviewed this week Joe Lieberman, who of course is supporting McCain. Obama took Joe Lieberman aside on the Senate floor a couple weeks ago to take him to task for not denying more forcefully when asked at a Republican campaign event about whether Obama was a Muslim. The Obama people see this as an issue that they need to address pretty head on.
Do you know exactly what Obama said to Senator?
Well, I know what Senator Lieberman says. I have one account of this conversation where Senator Lieberman says he congratulated Obama on a breakthrough nomination and said it meant a lot to him as someone who had worked in the civil rights movement, and that Obama then said that Lieberman's own breakthrough candidacy in 2000 as the first Jew on a national ticket was one thing that made it possible, his own breakthrough, but then said there's something I've been meaning to talk to you about and raise this issue of this exchange he had at a Florida event.
And that's according to Senator Lieberman.
That's correct.
Okay. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Junction City, Kansas. I think that's Susan's home state. Go ahead, Brian. You're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to ask the panel if they think that either of the candidates or Congress has the courage to lower the speed limit on federal highways to 60 miles an hour, which would save a lot more oil than drilling off Anwar or anywhere else.
Brian, you know, we talked about that this week on this program, and that does seem to be a big issue if drivers would cut back to 60 miles an hour. I think we'd probably save a lot of money and gas.
I don't think there's, in response to Brian's question, I don't think there's any chance that that Congress is going to do that. It was pretty unpopular efforts to control the speed limit. And I've got to say, in my home state of Kansas, when you're going across that turnpike, going across that flat state at 60 miles an hour, it's pretty slow.
So no chance. Sorry, Brian. Let's go to Jackson, Mississippi. Good morning, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, everybody. I want to address the question of why don't cars get better gas mileage? And my answer for that is something I call horsepower inflation. Now, if you look at the last 20 years, there have been staggering advances in the efficiency of gasoline engines. But what it means is the average car is a lot more powerful than it used to be. So, for instance, in 1986, like a 2.5-liter four-cylinder got about 100 horsepower. Today, and this isn't a mid-size sedan, today that engine will get about 170 horsepower. And I'm not talking about turbochargers or anything like that. This is just an accumulation of minor improvements. But the thing is that the car companies, whenever they made an increase in efficiency, they invested it in increasing the horsepower, not the gas mileage. So rather than say, oh, same performance, better gas mileage in the new 08, you know, car, they would always go for same gas mileage, better performance.
What do you think, Tony?
Well, I mean, that's exactly correct because that's what customers wanted. The cars that had the higher horsepower and drove faster is what the customers wanted. So they responded to the marketplace. Now that the people apparently want better mileage, they're going to try to put out as many more efficient engines as possible. You see ads all the time, Chevy claiming all of their cars that get high mileage and the rest. Meanwhile, they're not advertising the SUVs much anymore. So,
but you know, why is it that Detroit happened to be behind Japan and other country manufacturers.
That's not true. The Japanese cars have been advertising and offering high-powered engines.
Sure.
I own a Japanese-made car that has 340 horsepower. So everyone who's selling cars in the American marketplace over the last 10 years, 12 years, have been offering more muscle in their engines because that's what the public wants.
But the Japanese have also been offering better mileage on the cars.
In some of their cars.
Right.
They're producing as many high-engine cars as they can that they can sell, and I'm one of their happy customers.
So are we going to see pressure on Detroit, or is the marketplace simply putting that pressure on Detroit right now?
Oh, I think the marketplace is speaking and speaking with a pretty loud voice now. That's why people are beginning to buy those tiny little smart cars, and they're buying, you know, Mini Coopers, and they're not buying SUVs, and they are asking for better gas mileage. You know, one big question is whether we will finally become a substantial importer of diesel cars, as diesels are very popular in Europe, where gas has long been $6-$7 a gallon or more. It's gone up to, you know, diesel has actually gone up to $10 a gallon.
Diesel fuel is now more expensive than gasoline.
Right, but the mileage is much, much better.
Syndicated columnist Eugene Robinson of The Washington Post, Susan Page of USA Today, and Tony Blankley, he's research fellow with the Heritage Foundation. When we come back, more of your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Hamas and Israel agree to a 6-month ceasefire. Afghan and NATO forces fight back against a resurgent Taliban. And a car bomb kills 63 in Baghdad. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And to reports from the Associated Press, Barack Obama's campaign announced Friday he's going to campaign with former rival Hillary Clinton next week, a step toward unifying a fractured Democratic Party after a bruising primary fight. And also, Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York urged Jewish voters to denounce the whisper campaign that for months has pushed the false rumor that Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is secretly a Muslim. Susan, where is this coming from?
You know, I think there is. I think one thing factor is his name, Barack Hussein Obama, which some conservative commentators have focused particularly on the middle name. But I was at a focus group of undecided Virginia voters that was sponsored by the Annenberg School about a month ago in Charlottesville, Virginia. And of the 12 independent voters, undecided voters who were there, six of them said they believed Barack Obama was a Muslim. And it's a problem for the campaign because Barack Obama is a Christian.
And is there a concerted effort on the part of those who oppose him to try to spread that rumor and make it stick?
You know, I don't think this is a McCain campaign effort. But I do see when you go on blogs, you do see a lot of people who are opposed to Barack Obama's election raising this issue or promoting this inaccurate rumor.
All right. Let's go now to Todd, who's in Madison, New Hampshire. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. I'm just curious on maybe we don't drill so much in the United States because back when in Texas, when they found oil and started drilling, depleting a lot of those wells, wouldn't the price go up more as you deplete those? Meaning any places that we have left, wouldn't it be wiser to let them set? And at the same time, the price of fuel will go up. And now the countries, they say wars are fought upon oil. That would leave us with the oil at the end since we pump it all out of, you know, the other countries.
When he has this argument, look, we're going to have increased world demand for oil for the foreseeable future. America has vast quantities of untapped oil. The shale oil in the Colorado Rockies alone equals the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia. America has a vital interest in having less oil coming from abroad, and two, to increase the world supply to bring the price down. Right now, with the 85 million barrels being used by the world every day, is at such even balance between supply and demand that the slightest rumor of a Nigerian rebel raid and gas goes up another $3 a barrel. If we can get just a few million extra barrels into the world supply, we're going to make it a much more stable marketplace. So there's a tremendous advantage to the whole world to get production up all over the world, including the United States.
But hasn't Saudi Arabia already agreed to pump
only a couple hundred thousand barrels? They don't have
500,000.
Yeah, they don't have the big tap like they used to.
They have some pretty big taps. Yeah. Though.
It used to be said they could turn 2 or 3 million barrels a day on or off if they wished. Now, they've not been able to do it. They haven't done
they've
it.
They've
so
not
far.
Been able to do it, or they it, haven't
they
done
it.
That's
it.
The question.
Yeah.
Let's go to Panama City, Florida. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Diane. Quick question on these loan bailouts. I personally know several realtors that were very irresponsible, and they have told me myself that they just had to take a chance on buying these homes because, great, they had to purchase these homes to turn around and resell them and make quick cash. Why should we be responsible for covering folks that knowingly were being irresponsible?
And that's the division between those individuals who were buying their own homes and real estate speculators.
Well, yeah, I think that seems to be the division that everybody wants to make, the distinction everyone wants to make, speculators versus, you know, first-time homeowners who just wanted a roof over their heads. You know, it does get difficult at the margins to make what are essentially moral decisions about you know, you were buying this house for this reason, therefore you don't deserve to get bailed out, whereas you were buying it for this other reason, which you think is more noble. There is a distinction, but it's
there
not always
there ought to be a distinction, shouldn't there, Susan?
Well, there is a debate over, even when you talk about individual home buyers, so if they put no money down, they bought a house that was more expensive than they could afford, should they be bailed out? And of course, in some cases, people were misled. They were victims of predatory practices. They didn't fully understand what they were getting into. They didn't understand what was going to happen to their interest rates. It is a complicated debate. There's also the reality that the fact that they're in such trouble is undermining communities, has effect on people who aren't don't have a mortgage at stake, but is hurting the economy to agree that some people say we need to have a bailout for them to protect everyone else.
All right. Let's take a call from Hocking Hills, Ohio. Good morning, Debbie. You're on the air.
Good morning. My comment is I'm a little confused about Barack Obama being a Christian, in that I don't see anything wrong with anyone being a Muslim or a different religion other than a Christian to be president of the United States. I felt kind of like we're being real defensive and trying to make sure everyone believes he's a Christian. I don't necessarily think that's, you know, the only thing someone can be.
You know, Debbie, I certainly agree with you, and I bet the Obama campaign agrees with you, too. On the other hand, politically speaking, it would be, I think, very difficult for a Muslim to be elected president. And so that makes them...
Now, at this point.
Maybe
at
not forever.
Point. Right.
I mean, there was a point where it would be hard to imagine that an African-American could be elected president.
Yeah.
But the fact is, he is a Christian. It's politically harmful to him if people believe he's a Muslim. But you're right. It makes it hard to deny it because you don't want to leave the impression that it would be so horrible to be a Muslim. Of course, it's not.
All right. Here's an email from an individual who's listening online from Atlanta, Georgia, who says, we have a public financing system to balance the power of corporate power against voices of common citizens. Obama, by raising gobs of money online from average folks like me and refusing to take money from lobbyists and PACs, has done just that. If McCain's campaign is hobbled by Obama's fundraising prowess, that's just too bad for the Arizona senator, especially since McCain's campaign appears poised to use every swift voting 527 he can find to smear Obama and, it seems, his wife.
Well, wait a second. I mean, this caller has, and I've never heard that McCain is involved in any way in raising 527, which, by the way, would be a federal crime if he was involved in raising money. So the caller is accusing him of committing a felony for which there is no evidence at all. Everybody, including the New York Times, believes the Democrats will have more 527 money.
He was directly involved. I think he says appears poised to use.
Well, if he's used, if he, I don't parse it, but the point is, I think the caller or the writer is trying to make a partisan point without a basis in fact. And let me just go back for a moment that although Obama has this tremendous small donor base of 1.5 million on the internet, he also, I believe, is beating McCain at traditional fundraising. The February numbers, which are old numbers, Obama was only raising 36% of his money with small contributors and 64%, whatever the difference is, with traditional above $250 contributors.
All right, let's go to Brattleboro, Vermont. Good morning, Arlie. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm glad that the topic of violations of FEC regulations came up, because it seems to me that the McCain campaign has some issues with that. They opted in and out of public financing during the primaries, and that really hasn't been dealt with yet, although I think that it's in the process of being dealt with. So for the McCain camp to make comments about Obama opting out now, I find that to be completely disingenuous.
Gene.
And I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, the caller is referring to during the campaign, McCain opted, I guess he opted in or said he would opt in order to borrow money. It allowed him to take out a loan, and then he was going to opt out again. So there has been back and forth by McCain on this issue. Look, everybody is disingenuous about campaign funding. I mean, I really believe that. Even if McCain and Obama, the two senators, sincerely believe that there is a way to make the American political system fairer and more representative through restrictions and controlling the money flow, when it comes down to it, campaigns are trying to get their candidate elected, and a certain disingenuousness comes in.
The McCain and the FEC is a real rat's nest of confusing facts, because McCain can't get a ruling from the FEC because there isn't a quorum, because there aren't enough members, and the Democratic Senate won't won't approve Bush's nominees. So McCain was caught in a situation where he couldn't get a ruling that some people think he would have automatically have gotten. So there's a lot of politics going back and forth in this.
All right. To Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Carlo. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. You know, I think that there's a financial interest that's not being covered by the press. The Bush family have long been involved in oil. They had offshore drilling rights off of Kuwait years and years ago. The same interests that have wanted us to drill in Alaska and more offshore were making these same arguments long before we were in the present circumstances. But until the price of oil got jerked up, it wasn't going to be in their financial interest. Now we've even got a president baiting the Venezuelan president, which only makes him want to rise the oil up. I mean, it's almost like there's a game being played here. Why aren't we putting money into environmentally sound alternative energy things? Because I think there's a financial elite who has a vested interest and relationships with the Saudis, and always have, and they're not shy about it. They have oil gum up, so they can all make more money here drilling in our country.
Susan.
Well, President Bush definitely comes to this debate with the perspective of an oil man, which he was, and he's long supported expanded drilling offshore and sees the $4 a gallon gasoline as a moment that might make that longstanding position more feasible. No, no question about that.
Tony.
I'm not sure if the caller was saying that Texas oil people have been keeping the oil off the market until the price goes up. If that was a point, if I understood him correctly.
Basically, that there could be an ulterior reason for doing this. I mean, things sometimes aren't always what they appear to be. I spent 6 years in intelligence back in the early 70s. You know, there's a lot of things that happen. I think the American public needs to sometimes look a little bit deeper into seeing who's profiting from decisions that are being made.
Well, I mean, there's always a backstory of some sort. I agree with the caller. But if the suggestion is that now is the time they want the drilling because the price is high, but the oil interests have been pushing for drilling and advertising on behalf of drilling for decades.
But
so
why
they've always wanted
aren't
it. Right, but
they drilling on the land they already have? That's what I don't understand. There are all these acres on land onshore that haven't been touched. And the question becomes, why? Why is there this push to go offshore when they're not even drilling on the land they've already licensed? At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Wilson, North Carolina. Good morning, William. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, everybody. Long time listener, many time calling,
well,
first time getting through.
Thank you.
Okay, Diane, I've heard a whole lot about Obama's religion. And what I want to know, can anybody tell me what McCain's religion is? And which church he attends on a regular basis, and I'll take my answer off there.
Well, I appreciate your call, William. Thank you.
He's an Episcopalian, but I don't know which particular church he
attends. He's an Episcopalian, but he regularly attends a Baptist church.
That's interesting. Okay.
Ecumenical.
Thank you, William, for your call. And let's go to Jose in Vienna, Virginia. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm a mortgage auditor by profession, and I have thousands of files go through my desk for lending from lending institutions and consumers. And in the last 6 months, I've probably audited about 1,500 files from settlement papers. And what we see every day is a pattern of continuous violations of federal law, such as the Truth in Lending Act, real estate.
How does that violation of federal law in the applications occur?
Well, because their finance charges are grossly understated, misleading the consumer into believing that it's going to be cheaper to buy the house than what it would really cost, which is a direct violation of the Truth in Lending Act. In many instances, people were not given the documentation. In many instances, the lenders were paying yield spread premiums or commissions under the table to the brokers to upsell or to sell higher interest rates and to put people in more at risk, in riskier loans.
And so, Jose, what is your responsibility as an auditor in that situation?
To educate the consumer and to educate the lender as to the violations of the law that they are committing. And as far as the consumer is concerned, to let them know how they could probably were basically victims of predatory lending.
But
once they have that information, they can probably have options for foreclosure defense.
Okay. Are you saying that you take a look at those financial arrangements before they're signed or after the fact?
Right. Either as a preemptive action or as a forensic action. And we are also looking into the situation in which most of the papers that we're seeing and people coming in with their documentation to our office, the lenders and the foreclosure attorneys, especially in Virginia and in many states, do not have the original promissory notes because they were either lost or destroyed.
Wow. And, of course, this is one of the arguments for bailing out some of these consumers mm-hmm. who may have been misled at the point they were thinking about getting these mortgages.
Well, the caller should report any evidence, credible evidence he has of that to his local United States attorney. Those are federal crimes. Those are federal statutes that regulate loans. And if he's got evidence, we think it would be useful.
I should say, what a way to end our Friday News Roundup. With Tony Blankley, he's syndicated columnist, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and Washington Post columnist, Eugene Robinson. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks for being here, Diane.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.